in part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. 352-5700. Nobody sells more real estate than RE/MAX, and they encourage you to join them in supporting public broadcasting. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Christie Clinic, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet, providing quality health care to the residents of Central Illinois.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with General William Odom, someone who is often quoted in the press, in the media, broadcast, and print, and is sought out for his opinions on military and security issues. Most recently, he has been widely quoted on the subject of Iraq and the U.S. involvement there, and has made some very strong statements about his feeling that the U.S. military effort in Iraq has been a failure. We should acknowledge that, and that the troops that we have there should be withdrawn as quickly as possible. This morning, we'll be talking about that, I'm sure, but also talking about some of the ideas that you will find in a recent book, which he co-authored. It's titled America's Inadvertent Empire, in which the authors make the argument that the United States is now at the center of an empire, but something different than those that we have seen in the past. Not a territorial empire, but an ideological one. And they make the argument that the biggest threat against this new type of empire is not some sort of rival power, but it is, in fact, incompetent American leadership. Our guest is now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. He's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University. He served as director of the National Security Agency from 1985 until 1988. Before that, he served as assistant chief of staff for intelligence, the Army's senior intelligence officer. And then before that, he was military assistant to the president's assistant for national security affairs, who was at that time Zbigniew Brzezinski. And as a member of the National Security Council, the staff there at the council, he worked on strategic planning, on Soviet affairs, on nuclear weapons policy, also on Persian Gulf security issues. He's author of a number of books, the one that we've mentioned here, also one looking at the problem of intelligence and how intelligence gathering is structured in this country. And that was published January of last year, that book titled Fixing Intelligence for a More Secure America. He has also written a book about the Soviet military, that book titled The Collapse of the Soviet Military, and that came out in 1998. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. All we ask of people who call in, please, is to be brief, just so that we can get in as many people as possible and keep the program moving. But of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. General Odom, hello.
Yes.
Thank you, sir, for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
We appreciate it. In the book, you make the argument that that American power now has several dimensions. The one that we probably think about the most and talk about the most is military power. And that's one that we can almost take for granted, that the United States has the most powerful military in the world. But you and your co-author also make the argument that there are other dimensions of American power. Perhaps we'll say it's a given that America has military power, but perhaps it would be worth taking a few minutes and having you talk a little bit about these other dimensions of American power.
Well, the most important thing that changes the nature of U.S. power in previous empires is liberal political institutions. By that, I don't mean the small L word, welfare economics. I mean Adam Smith, David Ricardo, John Locke, Immanuel Kant. The notion of a limited state and that individuals have rights the state can't abuse, and the first right being property, which is the kind of power that individuals, if they have, can ensure that a government will have a better chance to force a government to protect their other rights. And what the historical record shows is that the only countries that have been able to sustain great economic performance over a century or more are ones that have effective limited governments, that is, politically limited, and ones that act as kind of a third-party enforcer rather than a direct dictatorship or a tyrannous, illiberal democracy. So that distinguishes us. And it is that liberal ideology with a capital L that defines our empire. And countries are not formally members. They can be through military alliances, etc. But when they come into this, because they are liberal, they tend to do well economically, too. And this aggregates lots of wealth. Then what's what the U.S. has done since World War II, not just to contain the Soviet Union, but to construct a Western international order, is to create this set of international institutions, the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, and a number of others, act as a kind of supranational governance, rulemaking bodies that facilitate international trade and allow us to get even richer. And you can't dictate to these bodies. You have to get people to go along. Now, formally these things are sort of one country, one vote. But if that's going to be the basis, these things will soon go out of business. If you, they'll soon bog down and just be paralyzed like the League of Nations was, unless some power has enough, some state has enough power to kind of push it through in a careful, behind-the-scenes lobbying fashion. And that's been the role of U.S. hegemony since World War II. And if you look back at the decisions that have been made that are important, say, in NATO, like bringing Germany into NATO in 1955, which was opposed by almost every country in Europe, we spent 2 years humoring the French and others and eventually brought it about. We never dictated it to them straight out. And a kind of pattern has developed where my own experience during the Carter administration in the White House was that European and other powers expected us to do that. They wanted us to do that because they said our leaders are too weak to take some of these decisions, and you have to let us complain, and then at some point the president has to get us in the back room and say, okay, guys, we have to do this because it's really important for all of us. President Bush's father did that extremely well in the case of German reunification. He did it well in rallying a coalition for the first Gulf War. So that's what I mean by the special nature of U.S. power. If I just go briefly, the different dimensions, the ones we raised in the book, may be somewhat surprising. Demography is a huge advantage to the U.S. compared to Britain and the countries in Northeast Asia that are allied with us, like Korea, South Korea, and Japan. And another surprising gap and a very important part of U.S. power is what we call the university gap. The university feeds science. We just absolutely overwhelm any other university system in the world. In fact, if you could get into the top 20 or 30 graduate schools in the U.S., you couldn't find a school abroad that would be equivalent, even Oxford and Cambridge. Maybe there are some select areas where that would be the case. But this dominance of our university system is really extraordinary. You find the same dominance in science. You find the same dominance in mass communication. We're not ahead of everybody in the use of women power. Some of the European countries are, particularly the North European countries. But we are pretty advanced. And countries like Japan just haven't broken out of that pattern at all, so they don't have available half of their personnel base to commit to their economy as fully and the most efficiently as they could. See, mass communications, I've mentioned. One gap we did not get into was the high cultural gap. Very often people think, well, we're good at mass media, TV, and rock and roll, but not at Brahms, Beethoven, and Bach, etc. Well, again, we didn't do that in the book, but I think you'd find that there are more symphony orchestras in the U.S. than there are in Europe, and that there are probably more Bach and Mozart festivals here, too. So just across the board, any way you look at it, the U.S. just tends to be a huge, a powerful entity on multiple dimensions that radiating its impact out to the rest of the world. And I'll just sum up by saying, in addition to it being a liberal empire, the other two defining characteristics are that it has been a money-making, not a money-losing empire like previous ones, and as a rule, countries have fought to get in it, not to get out.
Well, this brings us to the central question. That is, having recognized the United States has that kind of power, then what do we do? And I think that now, particularly in Washington, within the circles where policy is made, there is a very strong commitment to the idea that the United States, by virtue of this power, has an obligation, one might even say a responsibility, to try to make the world as much as possible a peaceful, stable, democratic place, and also we have a commitment to a particular kind of economic system, and that what we need to be doing is to use the power that we have, to exercise that power in a way that will move the world in that direction. However, some people also would argue that it was in fact that very thinking that has gotten us into the situation we find ourselves today in Iraq, that perhaps we overreach when we think about remaking the world in our image or in that image that we think is most desirable. So that is the question. What, having had this, having recognizing that we have this power, what do we do with it?
Well, I agree. We have a responsibility to use it to improve things. That's easy to say. The question becomes where and how to use it to do that. And you can use it stupidly in a way that squanders it. You may have the best of intentions, but the outcome will be very negative. I think that's the case in Iraq. You know, we cannot be held responsible morally for things that really are beyond our power to control. I don't think anybody would recommend an invasion of Tibet to try to liberate the Tibetans. And I would put Iraq not far out of that category. So you go off in mindless ventures and squandering U.S. power, particularly when you do not have international support, then the cost to U.S. power go up dramatically and it shrinks rapidly when you don't have your allies aboard. And I think that's the test. Just look back at the reaction of NATO and the United Nations after 9/11. NATO had never invoked Article 5, which states the principle that an attack on one member of the alliance is an attack on all of the members. The Europeans took the initiative and invoked Article 5, saying that the attack on trade towers was an attack on them. We had over 90 countries participating in a set of five different sub-coalitions in the counterterrorism coalition. Within 6 or 7 or 8 months after the president had declared the Axis of Evil was part of the terror problem and moved the attention to Iraq, people said, look, we signed up to fight Al-Qaeda. We didn't sign up to fight Iraq. And even Saddam may be a very evil man, but anybody who's aware of the situation out there knows that that government, if anything, was frightened of Mideast terrorists. Groups because they don't like secular leaders and they want to overthrow secular leaders. Saddam was one. So that just puzzled the rest of the world, and we persevered. We slowly hardened this reaction against the U.S., and it just cost us more and more and more. And we've lost more and more allies, and we're ending up having to pay a very huge price for this. So I think what you're seeing is not a vindication of the view that we shouldn't use our power responsibly. It's that this is not a responsible use of it.
And I would imagine that you, a little earlier you were talking about the importance of the United States working with and through international organizations. I would assume that also you would be critical of the administration for its tendency to go it alone if people aren't willing to support the policy that we have laid out, and we have tended to brush aside organizations like the United Nations if they weren't inclined to do what it is that we said we wanted to do.
I not only would say that, I would emphasize it very much. You know, a lot of people say, well, we're not pansies. We can't be pushed around with these people. Oh, this is just idealism to think you're going to have government through the Security Council of the United Nations. Sure, it's idealism, but it's also hard power. And let me give you a demonstration of this, that why you do not want to go into business where dollars and cents and lives are at stake with people who have that view of these institutions. In the first Gulf War, we had the United Nations behind us. We had 245,000 troops, volunteers from up in the coalition. Some of those weren't very useful, but there were several armies in there that contributed rather significantly, in addition to the British. We had $70 billion of contributions from our friends, and the whole cost of the war to the U.S. Defense Department was just about that amount, so it came out as a wash. In this case, most of the people in the coalition are being paid by the U.S., so taxpayers are not even aware that they're subsidizing Ukrainians, Poles, and various other not very useful forces in that region. At the same time, we don't even like the numbers. The only good ones, really effective troops in there with us are right now are the British. The price, we don't even know. We do know that the real costs are exceeding $200 million now, and no one knows where the end of that cost line will lead us. Now, I don't see that that's very much an idealistic issue. That's dollars and cents and combat power that we fail to mobilize by being heavy-handed with the UN. Now, you might say that Bush didn't have the choice. The UN wasn't going to go with him. Well, then it may not have made sense to go, and I can get to why it didn't make sense to go in the first place. But let's suppose that what I say is not true, that it was in our interest to do it. If the president had allowed the French and the Germans to have their way for a while, I think by fall they would have come around. We've had that happen previously. You let them hang out there for a little while and prove that they can hold us to account, and generally they've come back on every critical occasion. They've come back and fallen in line. The issue is having the patience and having the skill. Now, if you stand on your high horse and say, well, we're a sovereign power, they can't order us around. If you are a pipsqueak power like France and Germany, you can stand on that kind of principle. But if you are an unparalleled superpower with no challenge, that's beneath your dignity. It's a bit like a parent getting down into a fight between two children. And that's what I think we failed. I think a lot of people in the American public sense that there is something wrong here. And it is that we've kind of climbed down on the children's level rather than keeping the moral high ground as we have traditionally in these international organizations. And that's why a lot of the world have been willing to go along with us. Let me give you an example. I was at a conference in 2001 in the summer in Warsaw talking about the European Union and its trying to achieve a military capability and NATO and its military capability. There were Germans, French, British, Poles, several other East European countries, Lithuanians, Latvians, Czechs, Slovaks, Hungarians. And the European Union group were pushing for greater military attention to the EU and less to NATO. The four East Europeans got up in sequence and read the Riot Act to the Germans and the English and the French who were making this case, saying, look, we will not take orders from Berlin, Paris, or London, or Brussels on military affairs. We will take them from Washington. Now, if they're willing to do that, there are reasons, and you do not want to act in a way that throws that attitude into question, because that is real power when countries feel that way about the U.S. use of military force. And clearly, we have hurt that image and that drawing power by invading Iraq.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, William Odom, is a retired U.S. military officer, Army officer. He is now working in the academic world. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington. He's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University from 1985 until 1988. He was director of the National Security Agency and is the co-author of a book that lays out some of these ideas here we're talking about this morning. And the book is titled America's Inadvertent Empire. It's published by the Yale University Press, if you would like to look at it. And the questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign County to start us off, line one. Hello.
Hi, I was going to call and talk about Iraq, and I heard you use the metaphor of a sinking ship just this morning, and it seems like you were suggesting, without naming names, and suggesting a course of action that the captain would resign. But it seems you're not talking so much about an inadvertent empire as just a more sophisticated one. To my mind, you're saying it should have been played better, basically. Whereas I think nations should get together, the United Nations, and look for common goods and common interests as opposed to being played one way or another. Back to the other idea of the inadvertency of this, as you were director of the Puzzle Palace National Security Agency, of course you know about all these documents, but the Kennan's document, which he penned for National Security Council Document 68, which describes the wealth and the importance strategically of the Middle East oil, is very explicit and should start with, I think, modern history, post-war, World War II history should start with that and look at what the not very inadvertent goals of U.S. policy have been through the decades. So I know we're going to have a little contentious time. I agree that this was wrongheaded on its own terms, it seems to me, but I think there are people that would say, well, it was also to just demonstrate hyperpower, and you know, it was to demonstrate that we didn't need anybody else, and obviously that's kind of been proven wrong, but we don't know what the limits of force are, and with another $26 or $28 billion dumped on the fire in the Middle East, we don't know how much carnage is to anticipate and how far they'll go with hyperpower to prove the point and make the case. There's a lot on the table there.
Yeah, well, General Loner, you can respond to whatever that that you'd like.
Yeah, I don't hear a question. I hear a peroration, a speech. I agree with a lot of it. I used the title just to tell you, I didn't want to use the word empire. As the word has grown up over the years, or as for centuries, we're not an empire by those standards. But I use the term only because a lot of people put the label on us. And so I said, if it's going to stick, let's redefine it. I also cite in the book the director of the Nobel Peace Institute, who referred to the U.S. as an empire by invitation rather than invading and taking people in forcefully. Most people have asked us in, and that was certainly true in the NATO case. We were pulling the troops out of Europe as rapid as we could after 1950 in Europe, even though we even joined the alliance. And if you a book I do cite in my book and in the bibliography about the basing of U.S. troops and how we moved them abroad, that's a very enlightening, interesting monograph. We didn't push them on anybody, not in, say, the 1950s and 60s. So, you know, we can quarrel over that. I don't think that's the real issue. The issue is how we use U.S. power effectively to our best interest. And it turns out, at least in the argument I make in the book, is that the way these international institutions have been built up, either by inadvertence or by intention, after World War II, the U.S. has to behave in a certain way within them. If they're going to continue to work effectively as they have in the past, and if we don't do that, we're going to pay in a considerable reduction of our wealth, as well as the wealth of other countries in the world as well. Let me just end on the business of the oil in the Middle East. I have never subscribed to the issue that we had to own those countries to get the oil out. And I think if you look back over U.S. policy, it's mixed in that regard there, and there was a great reluctance to get very much bogged down with military power there. And we only began to get bogged down after the Shah fell because we lost our footing in one of those camps. Our position in the Middle East has traditionally been based on keeping an even hand on both sides of the Arab-Israeli quarrel and the Arab-Persian quarrel. And when you lose your footing in one of those camps, about the only way you keep the balance in the region is to compensate with military power. And I was involved in the creation of Central Command, which starts back under the building up to it under the Carter administration, precisely because we lost our footing there. Now, one can make an argument, and I'll leave it to you to discuss this, that we should just abandon the whole region. I'm not ready to do that. I don't think, I'm inclined to agree that we have to, with our allies, we can't do it by ourselves, we have to have allied support to keep a kind of balance of power from Afghanistan to the Eastern Med. If we don't, it's like Brzezinski has said, it's the new global Balkans, and it can suck a lot of major powers in ways that just create chaos we really don't want.
Well, I don't know if I'm still on. There's a lot there. We put the Shah in, and we prefer not to use, the U.S. prefers not to use military force if it can engineer coups and set up satrapies that, you know, are compliant. So that's generally what we've done. And that's, as you're right, it did break down in Iran. And, Bush had to deny empire in his last State of the Union address. It's very exceptional for the word to even be mentioned, but he had to go out of his way, and that makes me think that, you know, I don't believe it. And I think people even like Chalmers Johnson with the book Sorrows of Empire, who came right out of the same kind of intelligence, maybe a little more academic, milieu as you, is now talking about the 1,000 bases around the world and just how much devastation it's going to do to the you know, people back here to maintain this empire. And we're seeing that very vividly in body bags and injured soldiers coming back. And I'm coming at it a completely different direction. I do agree with
You are. Can I respond to that?
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that is as gross a misdirection as Bush's unilateralism. What this leads to is dismantling U.S. power abroad. You'd be surprised if you talk to people privately in Europe about, it looks like we may not replace the two divisions in Germany as we bring them out of Iraq. If we don't, we're going to end up with no U.S. troops to speak of in Europe. That does not please the French or the Germans or the Poles or any of those people. While they won't complain about us, they feel much more comfortable in cooperating with one another when we have forces there. In the Far East, there are periodic calls to pull the forces out of Korea and Japan. There is no formula that will bring about Japanese rearmament and acquisition of nuclear weapons faster. And that will bring a Japanese-Chinese strategic competition, which will put an end to East Asian economic prosperity. You must understand that the case I've made in the book, it is the proper use of U.S. military power in this supranational governance role that has made the wealth and the effectiveness of these international organizations possible in the past 50 years. If you tear that down, we'll pay for it economically. Now, I'm quite agreed with you that you can question whether or not we should have put the Shah in by a coup back in 1953. The answer to that is that's past. We can't repeat that. We can't go back and redo that. What we can do is try to establish a rapprochement with the present Iranian regime. And we have tried that, but I don't think enough. And if we weren't so knee-jerk about nuclear weapons in the world, we'd just say, okay, if you want to have a nuke, go right ahead. You live in a tough neighborhood. And I think it would be preferable to get used to their nuke and have them support us in this bog down in Iran, Iraq, than it is to have them as our enemies, waiting to supply an insurgency when the Sunni insurgency dies down and they want to put the pressure on us with Shiite insurgents. So let me just sum up and say that we can draw absolutely the wrong conclusion from Iraq. I think going into Iraq was a very deleterious use of military power. To draw from that, we should just take the Chalmers-Johnson view. And by the way, Chalmers Johnson's record, if you follow it on Japan, couldn't have been worse advice for the United States. I mean, if you go back and look at his position on Japan, you'd wonder why you'd want to quote him on this case. It's easy to make the kinds of shots he's making. It is not easy to make a case of how to govern, how to use our power in the world by just taking these kinds of shots. So I worry about the reaction against the thing in Iraq going to the other extreme and dismantling alliances, which will cause an unraveling that will affect your pocketbook as much more than Iraq.
Just, I have two other callers, and I won't promise them we will get right to them. But just at this point, I would like to ask you if you can talk briefly about now, at this point today, what you think that we should do about Iraq.
I would go to the United Nations, ask them to draft any resolution they want to put an authority in there, and ask them, please, to contribute troops. And I suspect they won't do it. But if they did, I would go along with that. But at the same time, I would say, I'm beginning to phase my troops down, and we're going to have them out within 6 months or so. And if they don't do that, then I would begin to phase them out unilaterally. And it wouldn't make any bones about it.
What that would be on the part of the Bush administration and the U.S. government, an admission of failure, an admission that they made a number of wrong choices, which I'm sure is not easy when you're in a position like that, to essentially stand up, even though you wouldn't perhaps be literally doing it, but in fact you'd be standing there in front of the world and saying, we screwed up.
Well, the normative U.S. power is such that we can do that and get away with it. The idea that we can't afford to do that because of our credibility just greatly underestimates U.S. power. We would be applauded for it. I think other countries would be appalled that we had the forthrightness to do that. I think it could be a great political victory for us in a bizarre kind of way. They probably won't do it. The issue is, I mean, I'm often asked, well, we can't afford to fail now. We failed when we started the war. The implications of this war were pretty easy to foresee in advance, and there were quite a few people that foresaw them. My fellow military officer, General Zini, who was a CENTCOM commander before General Franks, he and I were both quoted in the Washington Post in February of 2003, speculating on what some of these adverse consequences have been. He was right on. So it wasn't hard to foresee this, and I don't see how you make it easier for yourself by staying in longer. And I'll put it in a rather straightforward metaphor. It's to say we can't afford to fail, that we can't afford to get up and apologize, is like saying, you've just murdered a man, and you say, well, I can't afford to have committed the murder. Well, unfortunately, Lazarus is not here to raise him from the dead. When you invaded, that was the inexorable outcome. So I think putting it in these sharp kind of terms is kind of essential. And the only reason I haven't said anything about this publicly before 28 April, from before the war until then, I've let it go. And I've done it now because I think it's pretty hard to argue that it's been a great success or is about to be a great success. And I figure if somebody with a military background and is willing to say this openly, that others will feel free to get out and debate it. I don't want to be the center part of this debate any longer than I have to. And I must say I've had remarkably positive responses from mail, et cetera. But I'm sure I have many more detractors, and detractors never send you messages unless they're to call you bad names, which a few have done.
Yeah. Well, we have about 20 minutes left. We have several callers. For the benefit of anyone who's just tuned in, I'll introduce again our guest. We're speaking with General William Odom. He's a retired U.S. Army officer. He's now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. He's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University. He served as director of the National Security Agency from 1985 until 1988. Before that, he was assistant chief of staff for intelligence, the Army's senior intelligence officer. And then before that, he was military assistant to Zbigniew Brzezinski, the assistant for national security affairs under the Carter administration. And at that time, as a staff member at the National Security Council, he worked on a number of issues, including Soviet affairs and nuclear weapons policy and also Persian Gulf security issues. Questions welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hi. Just to kind of go back to the beginning of this Iraq thing, I never have understood why we're mad at Al-Qaeda. We're going to invade Iraq. Can you explain why how that's logical or what is missing in that sequence?
If I understood your question, I wasn't hearing very well, that you never understood why invading Iraq had to do with Al-Qaeda?
Yes, I think that's precisely the question.
I think you are very clear-minded. I never understood that, and I don't know why the president switched directions in that regard. I've tried to emphasize again and again that the two parties most pleased with the U.S. invasion of Iraq are Al-Qaeda and the Iranians, who were invaded by Saddam back in 1980, and they fought a bloody war for 6 or 8 years. So you're very clear-minded, and don't let anybody confuse you on that.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's go to Urbana. This would be line number three. Hello.
Yeah, well, I think a large part of the Iraq thing had to do with protecting Israel myself. But I wanted to ask you about a couple of... I also wanted to say that your characterization of... U.S. hegemony, superiority or dominance anyway of culture and education and things like that. I think in terms of this hemisphere, and we're very much against any kind of self-determination in this hemisphere, and I don't think our prestige is quite what you apparently imagine it. Particularly in this hemisphere, you know, people like Chavez and Aristide, elected people we actively work against, and the whole world sees that. I want to ask you about a couple of comments in a BBC series that happened earlier this year, which was entitled The Age of Empire. It was a 6-part series. I believe they have it archived. And one of the episodes was called America, the Accidental Empire, which I thought was kind of interesting. You might want to look into it. But anyway, couple of comments I was kind of interested in was your comments on, like, Strobe Talbott says, is quoted in this series, of saying, when our friends around the world get together behind our backs, they talk about the problem of American power, how to cope with it, manage it, even how to contain it. And then they also quote Joseph Nye, where he talks about the paradox of American power. And he argues, to quote them again, he argues that in terms of issues like countering transnational terrorism, dealing with the spread of infectious diseases, global climate change, international financial stability, none can be managed by any one country, unquote. Could you talk a little bit about where you think we're going or how to get to a point where we can be more cooperative with the rest of the world? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Well, you know, I think I'd strongly encourage you to read the book because it'll disabuse you of the view that Chavez and Aristide are the countries that characterize most of this hemisphere's attitude toward the U.S. The Mexicans, after years and years of being hostile to the U.S., fought to get into NAFTA. Anti-Americanism in the Third World started in Canada in 1776. And they want in NAFTA as well. Chile wants in. Lots of others. Aristide and Chavez are hardly constitutional-minded leaders. You know, that's a more complicated issue. I didn't see the series. You can always focus on particular episodes and miss the big picture. The big picture is that countries like Russia and China and India, who've talked a lot about multipolarity, which is a word, a code word for anti-Americanism and balancing American power, they get together and they swear they're going to do this. Meanwhile, behind each other's back, they're trying to cut deals with the U.S. to get into a special relationship with us. Now, that may not be because they particularly like us, but it turns out you make money if you're in a U.S. relationship. And that's why most countries in the world have tended to do it. The remarkable thing is, in spite of the unilateralism and the rather brash and, I think, really undiplomatic and offensive tactics the Bush administration has used to deal with the Europeans, they still want to cooperate on a whole number of fronts. And the business world in the U.S., I know a little more about the German connection here, the German businesses, also French and other businesses, immediately begin working with the U.S. business to try to improve the relations between U.S. and Europe after Rumsfeld talked about old and new Europe. So there are lots of forces in the world who don't get up and talk about it every day, but who, in the breach, realize that this hegemonic role the U.S. plays is more beneficial to more people than it is deleterious to, and I'm not saying it is not deleterious to some. So I would just encourage you to read the book. I can't give you an adequate answer right now.
Let's go to another caller. We have someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Could you give us your view on the use of contractors that the military is using, say, in lieu of its own forces?
Well, that's a complicated question. My short answer is we couldn't operate without some, particularly in the logistics and supply area and maintenance, because the high-tech equipment, we can't keep privates and sergeants trained up to the technology levels to make that stuff work, so the vendors tend to supply those kinds of people out there. Nor will we ever have enough combat engineer units to substitute for Brown and Root. The degree to which we ought to use translators, interpreters, and these sorts of things, that's affected by whether or not we have them and they're available. And it's been very hard to keep an adequate number of Arabic linguists at the fluency levels we need on active duty. Lacking that, I don't see much option but to go to contracts.
So you're saying they're less expensive?
No, I don't think anybody's proven that one way or another. In some areas, I think it's very true that they're less expensive.
I mean, because there's the issue of accountability. I mean, if you're...
Well, that's right. When the accountability is the issue, I just think if it's cheaper, I'd pay the price and make them accountable. I do think there's some issues of accountability that are surfacing out there that the Pentagon's going to have to work through, and the Congress is too. And we just haven't had the experience factor to know what the smart thing to do in that regard is. And in fact, there's a woman in a PhD program at Georgetown who's trying to do a dissertation on that subject, a very good subject. Accountability is a major issue with her.
But, I mean, they've been using contractors, I guess, since Vietnam, if not before.
We have massive numbers of them. We had them in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Contractors are not a new thing.
But, I mean, their numbers continue to go up, if I understand it correctly.
Well, I don't know the numbers, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're considerably more than traditionally been the case in previous wars. But there were large numbers out there during the first Gulf War.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Other comments are certainly welcome. We have about 10 minutes left. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to ask you if you wouldn't mind commenting. I'm sure you have some thoughts about the current controversy involving charges of abuse of prisoners in Iraq. Just yesterday, General Taguba appeared before the Senate and talked about the report that he had done on these charges, and it seemed to be saying that he felt that this misconduct was not the result of orders that these soldiers had received from higher-ranking officers. However, the impression that you get from those people who have commented, that is those soldiers who have talked about this, you get the impression that they were told what to do, or if not specifically what to do, generally what to do. And the big question now is exactly where in the chain of command is the responsibility located? And some people say that it's maybe at the level of the people who were the commander of these soldiers, and then some people say that it goes all the way to the top, and some people, of course, have called upon the Secretary of Defense to step down. And I wonder, Ed, as someone who has experience in military and security matters, and how you think about all this, particularly this issue of where responsibility for this lies.
You want me to do that right now?
Yeah, if you would.
Let me give you the term I think you were searching for, and that's to what extent was the command environment conducive to this kind of behavior, instead of this kind of behavior being the result of direct order. That's the question. And commanders have to be held responsible for the command environment. And one can make a case that goes very high. And I'm going to leave it to the Congress and others to, as an ex-military officer, I think I ought to be out shouting for scalp of the Secretary of Defense or others. I can just make the observation that I don't think we ought to have double standards of accountability, and that they don't ask a skipper of a ship, if it runs aground, whether he told the he failed to tell somebody to do 30 degrees right rudder. He may be asleep, and some lieutenant on the bridge drives it into a sandbar. I don't think they would say, well, the lieutenant is to blame, therefore we'll let the captain off. They don't even ask questions. They relieve him. In Vietnam, people were relieved at the drop of a hat in combat. This is combat. So I think the Congress is being much too slow, not nearly as active as it should be, on this issue. They're just sitting up here making pompous statements for the press. They need to act as Madison and the Founding Fathers wanted them to act, as concept of separation of powers. I don't think this is a Republican or Democratic issue. I think it's an issue of effective military command in the region. And we just can't abide this. Look at the damage it's done to us. Mm-hmm. If you talk about trying to not fail before, I don't see how we'll overcome this blot on our record for a very long time.
Well, do you think, I mean, setting aside the issue of who should resign and when, do you think that the military has been quick enough to respond, or has responded adequately? Because I think as some people would agree with your assessment of the...
The answer is no.
Yes.
I mean, when they first heard those in the International Red Cross report...
Yes.
If the command didn't already know that, should have moved with alacrity at that very point. Mm. But you see, this whole mood goes back to Guantanamo, and we've been talking about that since the war started.
Well, we
look at the behavior of the Attorney General and others. If you were a trooper out there, why would you not feel that you're in a fairly permissive environment?
Mm. I'd like to try and get at least one or two people in the time that remains, and we're
sure.
Getting short on time, so we'll go to somebody in Chicago here, which is line four. Hello.
Hello. I just wanted to give you the statistics that I've heard, the use of mercenaries.
Pardon, could you say, let's speak a little louder?
Okay, I'm sorry. I wanted to give you the statistics that I heard as far as the use of mercenaries. They're supposedly 1 in 10, so it seems like they're trying to fight this war with mercenaries and reservists. And my question is, or maybe this isn't a question, maybe this is just a comment, but to me this whole problem seems to be because we had no reason in being there. I think the Army has absolutely no focus, so they don't know how to train people or what to train them for. They just need know that they need more bodies, but they don't know what to do because they have no reason to be there. The army cannot bring democracy, and it can't develop governments. And since that's what's actually needed there, the army is just floundering. And when you look at, and no one's taking responsibility, at least from the Secretary of Defense or anyone else. And so I guess that was a comment, not a question. Thank you.
All right. Well, I guess
Just comment briefly on that.
Yes, please do.
You have a mercenary army because you have a volunteer army. I don't know why you don't have a draft. You should go back to a draft. Americans, particularly the upper socioeconomic elite, are dodging a responsibility. If the kids going to the best schools in the country don't become part of the military leadership, they're not willing to go over and fight, what do you expect? Number two, the military wanted very much to have a civil affairs program. They wanted in addition to the 130-some-odd thousand, another 200,000, which is probably still too few troops, to go in for a security phase afterwards. They were told by the Secretary of Defense, that's old think. We don't do that. So the military is not incompetent here. The military was forbidden to do these kinds of things. So I realize you may not have information in advance that clarifies that to you, but you ought to know that that's the case. I mean, you talk about frustrated people that know how messed up it is. Go talk to some of the people in uniform. They're not confused about this. They weren't confused about it before they went in. But they follow orders. And so don't blame them. They're taking political leadership. Go ask the political leaders which you elected.
There, I think we will have to end. I'm sure we could continue, and we have some other callers. My apologies, we can't take. We're simply out of time. I'm sure also on other shows with other guests, we'll continue to talk about these issues. If you're interested, by the way, in reading some more on the subject of America and its place in the world, some of the thoughts of our guest, look for the book that we've mentioned. It's titled America's Inadvertent Empire. It's published by the Yale University Press, co-authored by our guest, William Odom. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington. And General Odom, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We appreciate
Pleasure.
It. Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll try to get some perspective on the current situation in Haiti. Celeste Quinn, host for the show, she'll be talking about Haiti's history, in particular the Haitian Revolution of 1791 and the Proclamation of Independence of 1804. Her guest in the 1 o'clock hour will be historian Laurent Dubois. He's the author of The Avengers of the New World, and they'll be talking about the legacies of slavery and colonialism in Haiti. That's as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The show itself gets underway at noon with the usual mix of news and sports and weather right here on this station, AM 580. Celeste Quinn is the host for the program, and we hope that you will stick around for that. In the next part of this show, we'll be taking on a topic maybe a little bit more pleasant. We'll be talking about birds and bird watching, and our guest will be Larry Keller. He is owner of Wild Birds Incorporated of Champaign and Peoria, and we'll invite those kind of questions coming up in just a little bit. We'll have some news for you at 1 minute past the hour, news from National Public Radio, and before that, an update on the commodity markets.
Dave, and good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. After a higher opening, there is a lot of red across the board. Taking a look at the current tick, May wheat at 367 down 3, July 370 down 9, May corn 393 down 3, July 297 and a quarter.